You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Sunday, January 17th, 2021, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Skepticism on a Sunday. I love it.
This is a rare Sunday recording. We're doing this because of the 12-hour show next Saturday, which is the Saturday this show comes out. I probably will be posting this up right before we begin the 12-hour show. So if you're listening to this on Saturday that it comes out, we're probably in the middle of the 12-hour show. Why aren't you watching that instead?
Yeah.
And leaving this to console you on Sunday or Monday because the 12-hour live stream is over.
Priorities, people.
That's what
come
I recommend. On. Right. So we're not, I keep saying, like, we're trying to get away from doing the COVID thing every week, but there's always stuff to talk about that has to do with COVID. So I just want to say one thing about it. Obviously, it's still raging. The numbers are getting scary high still. It's just crazy. But David Kessler was announced as the COVID czar for the incoming Biden administration. Do you guys remember who he is?
Yes.
Kessler. He was in the American Werewolf in London movie, right? Was
that exactly. Mr. Kessler.
No. He was a former head of the FDA in the 90s. And after his stint at the FDA in the 90s, he was the president for a while of Yale School of Medicine.
Huh.
Oh,
yeah, that's how I know him.
You have him on speed dial?
I don't know him personally, but you know.
Oh.
He's the commissioner of food and drugs for H.W. Bush and Clinton also.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Sounds nonpartisan. I like that.
Yeah, yeah. He was very much opposed to Deshae, the Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act of 1994, which was a terrible law, still is a terrible law.
Yeah.
And he was completely correct in his opposition to it. So hopefully, you know, he has a lot of experience. Hopefully he'll, you know, will prove to be the right person for this job. And we're hoping to shift into high gear with
the whole pandemic, Steve,
in 3 days. Yeah.
Did you hear that Biden is elevating, he's making a cabinet of science?
Yes. Yes. Oh, the good. Science and technology whatever is now going to be a cabinet level position.
Yeah, he's developing a cabinet level position. The first ever cabinet. Which will not be in the line of succession, by the way. It's a cabinet level position, but it's not a cabinet position.
Oh, I thought he was building a cabinet filled with cool science things.
like a curio cabinet?
Yeah, like my closet of mystery. You don't remember that from...
Yeah. Yeah.
What is this endless fascination with the forbidden closet of mystery?
But it is really cool. I mean, it's the first time a president has ever put somebody at that high a level in a science position, which kind of just shows his commitment to evidence-based policy. And also, Frances Arnold, who I'm super excited about. You guys remember, she's a Caltech scientist who recently won a Nobel Prize. She's going to be within his group. I'm not really sure how everybody's designated quite yet, but within that group of scientists, which is very exciting.
I think it should be like the bridge of the Enterprise D, where you've got the president, the vice president, and you've got the czar of science right up there with the big boys, because that's where it belongs.
You mean in the position that that Council of Troy was in on Next Generation?
That's what I'm saying.
Sitting,
truth
sitting
be told,
to the captain's left. Nice.
I am kind of glad that it's not a, I shouldn't say this, I don't know. I don't know if I would want it to be a cabinet position because then all of a sudden, because then they enter into the line of succession. And I do worry that whoever is appointed could potentially be president.
But isn't that a worry about every single cabinet level position?
Yes.
Cabinet member? I mean, is there a cabinet member you think, yeah, this guy's ready to become president on day one? I mean, unless you've watched the sole survivor.
Some of those people have served in previous administrations.
Yeah,
you know,
that's
they
true.
At least have worked in government.
But, listen, it's obviously never happened. It's so unlikely that I don't think someone's going to pick or not pick a cabinet member because they don't think that they're ready to be president.
Yeah. I mean, and why wouldn't a scientist or a science-minded person be good as president? I think that's what we want.
They wouldn't necessarily be.
It would be, but they would still need to be somebody who has, you know, executive leadership skills.
All right, let's get right into some news items. Bob, is it true that astronomers were wrong about the number of galaxies in the universe?
Well, what?
Yeah, they're often wrong about stuff like that.
There's
that's okay.
One fewer
science
than they thought.
The estimated number of galaxies in the universe was recently cut in half. You are correct, Steve. So how the hell did this happen? And more importantly, what is the worst title for a news item covering this discovery? All will be revealed. So this all started years ago when the Hubble Space Telescope did some deep sky surveys, and it came up with the estimate for the number of galaxies, which was 2 trillion. Lots of galaxies, 2 trillion in the universe. It did this by doing deep field observations. These are observations that take a really long time, looking at the same patch of sky. So you're building up the photons, right? Just building up the photons, yeah, seeing what's revealed. And that reveals after a while that reveals the very, very, very faint galaxies. And then essentially, then it's easy. Yes, sir.
Bob, can we clarify? Are you talking about the observable universe? So just as a good point to a good time to clarify that the observable universe is a subset of the total universe, because some of the universe has moved beyond the Einstein limit, right? It's even traveling at the speed of light, the universe is not old enough for light to have traveled from there to here. So we can't see it. It's outside of our bubble, our light bubble.
Right. It's a little complicated, but yeah, I think it primarily, although not necessarily, you know, implies that it's just observable. But we'll see. Maybe we could let's revisit this at the end.
Okay.
So then once you have this patch of sky that you've looked at for a while, then you know how many galaxies, right? Then you just multiply that little patch by how many patches in the sky are there, and that's basically what Hubble did. But we knew that wasn't quite accurate, though. That's because there has to be other galaxies that are out there that are just too faint to be directly detected, even with the best deep field observation that the Hubble Space Telescope could muster. So those super faint galaxies, though, they do create a suffused glow, just a general glow in the galaxy. And now this background glow that I'm talking about is called the cosmic optical background, which is a term I hadn't seen before, which is fascinating because it reminded me of, and maybe you as well, the cosmic microwave background, which is the first light of the universe when it became transparent to electromagnetic radiation. The cosmic optical background, though, is the glow of all the stars that have been created since then. So the implication there, Steve, is that it because it's the glow that's been contributed since all time, that it might not be it might not be restricted by the observable versus unobservable universe, okay, in a sense. So and then that flow and that can tell us then what the upper limit of the number of galaxies are, right? Because if you can see that glow, then you can say, all right, using this glow, we can now estimate all the galaxies that would create that kind of a glow, that general glow in the universe. The problem, though, is that we can't get a good look at the cosmic optical background when you're in the inner solar system. And Hubble, Hubble is a fantastic observation platform, but it's constrained because it's in the inner solar system. And it's, the Earth has light pollution. So does the inner solar system have light pollution. And that's called zodiacal light. Have you guys heard of this one? Now this zodiacal light is the light that is created by the dust that's shed like COVID viruses, if you will, by asteroids and comets, reflecting the sunlight. That is the zodiacal light. So you have this glow in the inner solar system. So therefore, if you're within that glow, the zodiacal glow, you can't see the general universal glow. So you got to get away. You got to get out of that. And that's
so,
where...
So, Bob, is that in the plane of the solar system? Is that why they call it zodiacal?
Yes, right? You're right. So you
basically have to get out of the plane of the solar system.
Right. That would do it. Or you could take the route of just using a probe that's already outside that glow, and that's why NASA tapped into the New Horizon mission. Now this is the one that took those amazing, unforgettable pictures of Pluto. Remember those pictures? Oh my God, was it 5 or 6 years ago already? And also the Kuiper Belt object, Arrokoth. This was in 2015 and 2019. So they used now New Horizons is now 4.5 billion miles from Earth. And that area of space with so far from the zodiacal glow, that's 10 times darker than anything that Hubble can see. Way, way darker because you're outside of that glow. And that makes it far enough away to clearly see the cosmic optical background glow. And so this is the breakthrough that we're actually, looking away, from the Kuiper Belt and the inner solar system. We're like turning the New Horizons eyes to the outer, the outer universe, if you will, and seeing and measuring that glow. And that's what it did. So now looking at this unfiltered glow, if you will, this unadulterated glow, they created a new limit, a new galaxy number limit based on that glow. And it seems to be in the hundreds of billions of galaxies in the universe and not 2 trillion. So that's the crux of that. So they downgraded it because now it's a much more accurate assessment of that the glow, and the number went down. But how do we feel about this? I don't know. You know, both those numbers are so big, hundreds of billions compared to 2 trillion. The numbers are so big, it really doesn't matter that much, you know, in terms of many things that you may think matter. One reaction that I found, though, was ridiculous, and that was from a Fox News story. And the title was, NASA finds there are fewer galaxies than first thought. So far, so good. Leaving the possibility that we're alone in the universe. And that just made me cringe so, so hard.
That is cringeworthy.
Right. I looked at a lot of articles on this, and this one was the most ridiculous. Really? I mean, all right. So we downgraded the number of galaxies. So now, I really feel alone now. All right. So I did some rough calculations using averages. So 2 trillion galaxies, the old number, implies maybe, you know, roughly 100 quintillion potential exoplanets. But 400 billion galaxies, that implies only about, say, 40 quintillion exoplanets. So yeah, you went from 100 quintillion to 40 quintillion. Yeah, the odds of the life being out there really dropped significantly, and I really feel alone now. So it just maybe puts that into perspective a little bit. So yeah, that was just very, very silly title, ridiculous, but interesting. You know, interesting because the fact that there's less or there's fewer galaxies, you know, not a huge deal. But you know, I learned about, you know, the cosmic optical background and zodiacal light, all fascinating tangents related to it, which makes this news item even more interesting to me.
Yeah, so basically this was competing methods for answering this question.
And I wouldn't I wouldn't say they're competitive. I'd say that Hubble is just,
well, they're complementary.
Just a low res, a low res assessment, and this is a higher res assessment. You know, it's just a higher magnification.
But one is counting galaxies, and this is just measuring the background optical radiation.
No. I'm sorry. No, I missed a little piece. So the Hubble did the deep field to count the galaxies, and then it also assessed the glow as we could see that glow, you know, from the inner solar system. Whereas the Horizons kind of did a similar.
Horizons just did the glow. They didn't do a deep field. They don't have the kind of resolution.
Right. I don't think it did a deep field. Yeah, it couldn't have done the deep field. So it just did the glow. So basically, you're plugging in the accurate glow into the Hubble's deep field galaxy count, and that. So this is a new combined. Yes,
that's, I got that's it. The so best it was always it. A yep. combined thing, and now this is just replacing one of the sets of data. Got it.
The factor that was very fuzzy for Hubble, now it's been improved. Yeah. So that's okay, the way cool. to look at it. Great, thanks.
All right, Bob, you're talking about the size of our universe. I'm going to be talking about the multiverse. What do you guys think the multiverse has in common with the gambler's fallacy? So now we're combining cosmology and logical fallacy. Logic. So you know I'm all over this.
Right. So go over the gambler's fallacy, Steve.
So, well, hey,
as an intro.
It's the next one is going to be the one that hits. Maybe that the next universe in the multiverse will be able to sustain, you know, human life that has similar physics as our universe.
Well, you're close to the issue. So the issue is about the fine tuning question, right?
Right.
So the fine tuning question is, if you look at all the physical constants of the universe, they seem to be fine tuned to allow complex molecules to exist for sufficient time for life to evolve and intelligence to evolve, et cetera. So it must, right? They must because we exist. But, you know, here's the big assumption or a big premise. If those constants are determined at random, it's fantastically improbable that they would have the current constants, the current values that they have. That's a big if, right? So that's like the huge premise in the fine-tuning quote-unquote problem or the fine-tuning argument.
The fact that they're random?
Yeah. And not only are they random, but if you try to put a number to it, you have to assume a particular probability distribution. We have, of course, one data point, one universe. So we have zero idea what the probability distribution is. We have no idea if these laws are in any way variable universe to universe. They're obviously constants in our universe.
And we can't know, but doesn't that then just imply that there's probably then, if there is a multiverse, that there is so many of these universes that to increase the odds of having one like ours, right? That would imply
that's the whole idea behind the multiverse hypothesis. They say, okay, so if constants are variable universe to universe, and that they don't have to be the values that they are. There was some randomness to determining, like at the Big Bang, you roll the dice and these are the variables, that you get that come out.
Yeah, like you're rolling your D&D character.
Yeah, you roll up
a
universe.
You're rolling a D1000 or a D1000.
Planck's constant is, it's this one. And so that's the premise, right? So they're saying if that
any
is
any modifiers,
the case,
though, you think?
If that is the case, then it's fantastically unlikely that we would have a universe compatible with life.
Right.
You can also, as a side argument, right, there's so many side arguments here, you could argue that maybe there's a lot of different configurations that are compatible with some kind of life, maybe not our life, but we don't,
sure,
that would be interesting to do a simulation of not just, yes, if you change one or two variables, everything goes to shit, or maybe there's, In the space of variability, there may be many configurations that allow for some kind of complex life, whatever.
Right, but having one data point of life, it makes that an impossible question to answer as well.
Yeah, so we have no idea about any of this. But assuming this string of premises is true, then one possible solution is the multiverse idea. The idea, fine, there are infinite number of universes out there in a multiverse. Or maybe it's finite but massive, and so many that by chance alone, even if the constants of the universe are completely random, at least one universe would have popped up by chance. So if you get given enough opportunities, some right, universes will be able to sustain life, and obviously sentient beings are only going to be able to observe the universes that are compatible with sentient life, right? So there's basically an infinite number of universes out there that are incompatible with life that nobody's there to observe. So who cares?
Steve, are we making an assumption that there is a multiverse here? Like we're just going on that idea?
Yeah. No, that the multiverse is the hypothesis, is not the assumption. The assumption is that the constants are variable and from universe to universe, and they're random, and therefore they're massively improbable.
Right. So Jay, even if there was one universe, they would still be random. It was still a random, collection
right,
of numbers.
I find that idea so unbelievably profound. Like to think that the basic laws of our universe were created during the creation of the universe, I guess, right? Is that the
point? That's the idea. Something like that. So there's another possibility is that this is the sort of religious argument is that, God fine-tuned the universe for us. That's proof of God. That's just a God of the gaps argument, which doesn't solve the issue, the question at all. It doesn't really get us anywhere.
What if there is a global, and when I say global, I mean accounting for all the multiverses. What if there is a global meat space law or, the laws exactly like we are, every other one has to be the same way because it's still,
That's the other solution is that there are reasons that the laws of physics have 100% probability of being what they are because they have to be for some reason we haven't discovered yet. There are meta laws of the universe that dictate that they have to be this way, right? So it's not random. The probability is 100%. So that's one solution. So God of the gaps, we could dismiss that. Multiverse is one. The probability is actually 100% is another. And the final one is that there's one universe, it's very unlikely, but we hit the cosmic lottery. That's the most unsatisfying one, right? That, yes, we just happen to get a fantastically improbable outcome to the random laws, even though there's only one opportunity to do so. That's, I think, the least likely. Okay, now comes the gambler's fallacy. A bunch of mathematicians have argued, and then I was reading a Scientific American article by a philosopher, Philip Joff, who was reporting on this argument and agreeing with it and expanding on it, that the multiverse hypothesis as a solution to the fine-tuning problem, as much as it is one, is a logical fallacy.
It's
a logical fallacy that they call the inverse gambler's fallacy. So now this gets us to the logic part, which is what sucked me in. The gambler's fallacy is the notion that, let's say you're playing dice at the craps table, and then you roll snake eyes three times in a row, you think, well, it's really unlikely I'm going to roll it a fourth time in a row.
Yep.
But it's actually no more unlikely. Yeah.
Exactly the same odds.
Yeah, exactly. So the way I like to state it is physically independent events are statistically independent. And the gambler's fallacy is the failure to realize that. So you think that even though each individual roll of the dice is and should be, otherwise you're cheating in some way, independent random events, randomized events, then the past history does not predict future outcomes. So the numbers are not due. You're not in the middle of a streak. You know, those things don't exist, right?
Right. Okay.
So,
so what are they saying?
That's the gambler's fallacy. Now, the inverse gambler's fallacy is that, let's say, this is the example that the philosopher gave. Let's say you walk into the casino, you walk up to a craps table, and somebody rolls snake eyes. Mm-hmm. And then you think, oh, there must be a lot of people rolling dice in the casino to allow for, that was an improbable outcome. It's not, I mean, the analogy here breaks down because it's not that improbable, one in 36. Right. Let's say they rolled, that's, you know, you walk up to a slot, a better analogy might be, you walk up to a slot machine and somebody hits a jackpot that has a, you know, 10,000-to-1 odds.
Okay.
What would you think about that? That the first thing you see when you walk in the casino is somebody winning a 1 in 10,000 odd.
I would think that all the positive mojo just got spent and it's going to take time to build back up.
I'd say that's the gambler's fallacy for a while.
But the inverse gambler's fallacy would be to conclude that, well, there must be lots of people gambling in order for this one, and this is only one example, you know, one random event. But the fallacy is that doesn't make this event, the fact that other people are also playing slots doesn't make this event any more likely, right? It's still an independent event.
They're forgetting about the law of large numbers. When you have if you consider the entire population, the chance if it's a population of one, the chance of somebody hitting that jackpot is small. But if you have 1,000 machines together and you take them all at once, the chance is still small for one person, one specific person to win the jackpot. But the odds of someone winning the jackpot become very, very reasonable. Right?
Yeah, you're exactly correct. And that was my response. So that's the lottery fallacy, what you're describing. And I think the lottery, in trying to avoid the inverse gambler's fallacy, these mathematicians are committing the lottery fallacy.
Yes.
Because it all depends upon, this is why math, even to mathematicians and statisticians, can be so counterintuitive. It's always like, it's hard to wrap your head around how it really works. So like, if you are thinking about the odds of walking into a casino and somebody hitting some kind of jackpot, that's probable. Even though the individual, that person winning that jackpot might be very improbable.
Right.
Right. So if you walked up to somebody at random and they're the person who happened to win, that's where the inverse gambler's fallacy is valid, because it's just as improbable that that person won, whether or not there are other people gambling in the casino.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
To think that because that person won, it makes it more likely that there are other people gambling in the casino is the inverse gambler's fallacy. Does everybody get that?
Yeah, but basically what you're saying is all the events that happen in a casino are discrete.
Yes.
There is no connection.
Yeah. That's the premise.
No, there's no connection whatsoever.
They're independent events.
Some machines, though, are connected, right? You guys know this. And I'm not.
But for the sake of argument, that's considered one system. Yeah, for the sake of argument, we're going to say that all the events are independent.
It's based, when we think about it from a probability perspective, like go back to early stats, there's the difference between sampling independently and sampling dependently. So if you're drawing things out of a hat and you put them back every time, it's different than if you're drawing things out of a hat and you keep them out of the hat. In this case, we're talking about putting them back every time.
Right. No odd changes.
No odd changes. Exactly.
Right. Okay. So this is, I think, where it breaks down, where the philosopher and the mathematicians go wrong, is the universe in the context of the inverse gambler's fallacy or the lottery fallacy. So I'm going to use an analogy that the philosopher gave, Joff, that he gave, and turn it against him. So he used the following analogy. Let's say you wake up in a room. You're tied to a chair. There's a monkey sitting at a typewriter, and there's the Joker from Batman there. And the Joker said, I kidnapped you, and while you were asleep, I had the monkey type randomly on this typewriter. If they produced words in English, I was going to let you live. If they didn't, I would kill you. So you're alive. Obviously, the monkey typed out English. So he says, is the fact that you are improbably alive, does that mean that the Joker must have done this to other people? Uh-huh. And
what?
Or, right, can you conclude, oh, the Joker must have done this to lots of other people who died?
No.
Right, because
No, there's so many variables here. You can conclude that the letter A is an English word.
No, but we're saying that it was a very highly improbable, just for the sake of argument.
Oh, okay.
The monkey
typed the whole thing he wrote was in English.
Wrote out, I like bananas. You know, he wrote out a highly improbable English sentence, given that, you know, he was typing at random. Ooh. So what hypotheses would you derive from this?
Yeah, an obvious one would be that this isn't one of many, many different times that he's played out this scenario.
But the philosopher points out that is the inverse gambler's fallacy. It's still just as unlikely that you survived, mm-hmm. whether or not he did it to other people. Mm-hmm. But this is his attempt at addressing the selection point. It's like when you walk into a casino, you walk up to a random gambler and they win a big, highly improbable prize. There's no selection involved. But let's say you roam around the casino looking for somebody to yell bingo or whatever, and then you go up to them. There's a selection involved, and therefore that dramatically increases. Then you're in the lottery fallacy arena where it just somebody has to win something, and then you would be selected to that person. So he's saying that obviously that this represents the, you know, we're only observing a universe compatible with sentient life, and that doesn't rescue you from the inverse gambler's fallacy. And then he uses this Joker monkey typewriter thing as his analogy.
Right.
But I think his analogy is wrong.
I hate that analogy.
Yeah, it's not.
Yeah,
it's,
I mean,
not
whatever. Good. It's his analogy, but I mean, and you got to give a lot
it
of games.
Serves his purpose.
Just that it would be highly improbable, but, you know, probably not as improbable as it actually is. So, but I think he's incorrect. I think he's actually incorrect. Because he's saying that you still need to explain why you won. It's like, no, you don't. That's the lottery fallacy. That's like, if somebody wins the lottery, you don't have to explain why that person won the lottery. Even though that may be 100 million to 1 against, that person bought one ticket with one series of numbers and that they won. You know, let's say that that's the case. You still wouldn't need a special explanation for it. You would not, because, you know, highly improbable things will happen.
Yeah.
In fact, he's actually making an argument for the multiverse, logically speaking, anyway, given the premises, again, that we're going to. I said, to better illustrate it, imagine this related scenario. You wake up in a room with 4 other people. So now there's 5 of you in that room. You all were drugged and you wake up. Now you exchange stories and you realize that you all experienced the same thing. You were kidnapped by the Joker. You woke up in the room with the monkey and the typewriter. There was an English phrase on the typewriter. The Joker explained to you that he was only going to let you live if the monkey randomly typed out English.
Ah.
Would you conclude that you were the only 5 people that the Joker did this to? Or would you conclude he probably did it to a million people and selected us 5 because we're the 5 that survived?
Yes.
Yeah, of course.
That's totally reasonable.
Isn't it much more obvious if you put that little tweak on the example? You could also, of course, conclude that it's rigged, that the Joker's lying because he's the Joker, right? So that's it wasn't what it was. I also threw in there, you might conclude that the Joker inadvertently sourced his monkeys from a research lab that genetically engineered the monkeys to be super intelligent. And that would be equivalent to, there's some laws to the universe which we don't understand. And that explains why the universe is the way it is. It's not
right that there are constraints that will often lead us down this path.
Right.
Right.
So who is this punk philosopher, Steve?
No, I mean, it's, you know, again, it just shows you how counterintuitive this could be, right? So when I wrote about this on my blog, there's like hundreds of comments to it, but nobody apparently wants to. I wanted to say, like, am I correct? Even like I'm worried that I'm missing something because this is so counterintuitive, you know, this kind of statistics. Said, you know, nobody could really come up with a reason why I was wrong. They all wanted to talk about all the other things about the fine-tuning argument, which are wrong, which I was taken as a premise, right?
Right.
Because the article really isn't about the fine-tuning argument. It's specifically about the multiverse solution to the problem, assuming it's a problem.
Well, maybe
they all wanted to talk about
the
assumption. Yeah, we could. I do, actually.
And then we could, you know, talk about it and ask
I was hoping to reach out to him.
Are.
I agree. I thought it'd be a fun discussion. I wanted to first write about it, go through all the comments, you know, sort of grind it on our end. But the more I've thought about it and the more I've read people's comments about it when they're relevant, I think that my position is solid. Don't you think that he's committing the lottery fallacy? I think the five person thing. Now, you might retreat to the point that it doesn't prove that the Joker did it to a million people or that there are multiverses, and you're correct. But this is not about proof. It's about probability, because probability was the problem in the first place, right?
Right.
This is just changing it from a low probability to a high probability event, the laws of the universe, or the monkey typing on a typewriter. If it's selected from a much greater pool, then the massive improbability problem goes away. That's all the argument is saying. And they're wrong to say that it doesn't make the massive improbability problem go away, because they're committing the lottery fallacy.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Totally. I mean, the law of very large numbers is, you know, it's not obscure. I mean, that's like,
right.
You know, I remember discovering that years ago. You know, somebody had won the lottery twice, right? You remember the story?
Yes. Many people have won the lottery twice.
They won the lottery
twice. It happens every couple of years.
Yeah, and the news said that the odds of her winning, you know, the odds of somebody winning was like trillions to one. It's like, no, it's, if you pick a specific person, the odds of her winning twice is very low. But the odds
but
of somebody winning, right? They phrase it incorrectly. The odds of it happening.
They
very,
phrase
like
it the
one
way
in
they're
30.
Going to. Wait, but I don't think they phrased it incorrectly. They phrased
it
correctly for their purposes.
Yeah.
They phrased it incorrectly according
to
you.
It's misleading.
Well, no,
the odds of this happening
they phrased it incorrectly according to like math and logic.
No, if they had said the odds of somebody winning twice, but they said the odds of her winning twice.
You know, I don't know exactly how they said it, but I think what they said was incorrect. So they said that the odds of this happening is, you know, trillions to one. And no.
Yeah, I mean, quote unquote, this happening. Right. Well, what is this? You know.
Yeah.
But the other thing
is
they're even wrong if you're talking about the odds of that person winning twice, because they usually almost always calculate it as if they bought two tickets that won sequentially, rather than maybe they buy 100 tickets a week for 20 years and they won twice. Yeah, so they don't even really calculate it correctly for even the one person.
Right,
but they're either vague or they're not considering the difference between what are the odds of this person winning twice, what are the odds of someone somewhere winning twice. Again,
how many
lottery
games does this person play? All sorts of
But so if you consider all people playing all lotteries, somebody should be winning a lottery twice every couple of years, and that's basically what we observe. It kind of fits the probability that you would predict.
Yeah.
So anyway, again, this is not to endorse the multiverse solution. I don't think that I basically think the fine tuning thing is a non-problem, that, you know, you have to make a lot of assumptions, which I don't think are very good ones, in order to even make it a problem in the first place. The bottom line is we have no statistics. We have no idea. And there's probably my sense, you know, my guess would be, the probability of the constants of our universe being what they are 100%. They have to be that way, and we just don't know why yet. But I think that science will continue to move in the direction of figuring that out, you know, as we deepen and deepen our knowledge of the laws of the universe, you know.
Yep.
The multiverse thing might be true too. I mean, that's not ruled out by any of these arguments either. Maybe that's the case. Maybe there is a probability distribution, but again, we don't know what that distribution is. Maybe there's a massive number of universes. We have no idea what that is. It is probably separately testable in certain ways. Like, are there other universes? Maybe testable.
I hope so, man. That would be the discovery of the millennia. Holy crap.
Well, either way, whether there is evidence that would either support or refute the multiverse hypothesis would be interesting. But yeah, you can't logic your way to or out of that conclusion is the bottom line. We don't know enough. Okay, let's move on. Jay, how are we going to protect the artifacts that we left on the moon?
That's a great question. And if you listen to our interview last week that we had with Phil McAllister, we kind of like started talking about this maybe a little bit, but we had a wonderful interview with him going over details, getting into the details about low Earth orbit and everything. But I really wanted to know more about artifacts on the moon, like things that humans have left, and even things like footprints, and what becomes of those things. And I did ask someone that works at NASA, and she did say that, they have talked about it. They're aware that it's going to become an issue at some point. But then I found this article. What we found out was, one, that the boot print is very likely to still be there. It is most likely still there. And we know that there's no real erosion happening on the moon. Hopefully it wasn't completely destroyed by the activity of them walking in and around the lunar module. And, if a meteor hits the moon, yes, it will destroy things and put regolith all over the place and kind of bury it, right? But for the most part, the moon is sterile and it's dead. Nothing is really happening or changing fast there.
Well, Jay, what about when they took off from the surface?
Yeah. Disruption of the surface.
Without a doubt, Bob.
Isn't that a guarantee it's gone?
No, I wouldn't say it's gone, though. If you look at it, it really wasn't that bad. It definitely affected it because it was right there, but it did not destroy it. I've looked at that footage hundreds of times. It wasn't that bad. It looks more of just like a quick burst, and it seems to go out more horizontally, but you have to look at it.
And also, Jay, to be clear, there is erosion happening on the surface of the moon from micrometeorites striking the surface of the moon. And from what I've read previously, that will obliterate the footprint in about a million years.
So we have a little bit of time.
Yeah, I've got a little bit of time.
So there is a project called the One Small Step to Protect Human Heritage in Space Act. I know it's a little wordy, but they like to, have it be descriptive. So this became law on December 31st, 2020. The new law requires that companies who work with NASA on moon missions must agree to follow guidelines that protect landing sites that are found on the moon by American astronauts. So this is likely to have a very small impact on a very few number of people, but it is a sign of things to come. There is a significant amount of human history preserved on the moon that we should make sure isn't destroyed. This is also the first time that any country has acknowledged that something extraterrestrial has historical significance, which is big. And as we become a spacefaring species, now human history extends past the Earth. So they create this as a launch, as a launch into making more and more laws, right? So now that they have their foot in the door with this, they can use it to just continue to broaden the Human Heritage in Space Act. This was a great time to pass a law because, what are we seeing, guys? This past year in particular, we're seeing space travel become really common, and it's multinational. We have big countries spending billions of dollars getting people into space and having it be frequent. So on the NASA website, it says the Artemis project, as an example, will focus on demonstrate new technologies, capabilities, and business approaches needed for future exploration, including Mars, establish American leadership and a strategic presence on the moon while expanding our U.S. global economic impact, broaden our commercial and international partnerships, and inspire a new generation and encourage careers in STEM, right? So I totally get everything that they're saying there. And it is, it's very U.S. centric, of course, because NASA, it is a U.S. institution. But NASA is very international oriented and absolutely wants to work with other countries. So there's a little bit of a mix in there. But I think overall, the Artemis project really does want us to get to the moon and wants us to have partnership, and also keeping in mind that maybe even commerce happening in some way or another. Russia also has a lunar program that will bring cosmonauts to the moon in the 2030s. This is what they're saying. I honestly don't know how solid that estimation is, but it isn't unreasonable at all that they could do something in over a decade. China is planning on sending people to the moon in the next 10 years. India is planning a moon rover mission this year, and Japan and South Korea are also making probes and landers for future missions. So that's a ton of activity. Private companies are building components for NASA's mission, and we also have several private companies that are and will be capable of launching people into space. This includes space tourism, which we talked to Phil about. There is regulation that happens in outer space, but you know, the wording is vague. We don't have like these solid rules and laws and all that. Now, can you do whatever you want out there? No, you can't. What we have is an outer space treaty that was started in 1967 and is now ratified by 110 nations. And it outlines that all countries have access to all areas of the moon and outer space. This means that there's no property on the moon. You know, you ever like have someone try to sell you a parcel of land on the moon? It's not real. It's not going to happen. And it probably, if it does happen, it won't be for a very long time. No one has any limitations on where they can go. The only limitation is that in the treaty, you must not cause harmful interference. You know, basically it's saying play nice, you know, be respectful. And of course, you know, help people in outer space if you can, if you have the ability to help, you know, be there. But it doesn't really, there is no like iron fist coming down and saying you can't do this specifically and you can do this specifically. It's very vague. NASA knows that, you know, many of the Apollo missions have significant artifacts that are left up there on the moon. You know, there's probably even more stuff that most people don't even know about, just doodads that were up there, tools and all sorts of things that they brought with them that are still there.
Golf balls.
Yep. And this does include the footprints, the lunar rover, a lunar lander, you know, and
I think a plaque was left behind as well, wasn't there?
Definitely. The flag is up there. Yeah. So the One Small
Lasers
Step Act.
Or reflectors.
Yes, the reflecting plates. Yeah.
Oh, by the way, they use that reflector to this day. It's something that people use all the time to make measurements. The One Small Step Act does provide the platform, like I said, for further laws and, you know, the detailing of rules and conduct on the moon. Right now, it's limited to companies that work with NASA on moon missions. But in the future, you know, it's probably going to expand to protect places, people, objects. So real quick, like fantasizing about what would happen. So let's say that, you know, we'd establish permanent bases on the moon. And then they're like, okay, guys, you know, we have basically all the environments that we need. We have material up here. Let's build a museum. Let's build a museum on the moon that puts a you know, encases the footprint, encases the landing sites. So you
how?
Can actually,
how do you do that?
Well, you know, they would,
what do you
whatever.
Mean, encase?
I'm not a materials expert, but some type of clear, you know,
a bubble,
clear aluminum, a dome, something that will keep them from getting destroyed from outside influence, but also let people get close and see it with their own
eyes. That's it. That's the thing. And the dome really couldn't really do that very well. I was thinking just in my mind the past 10 minutes, thinking, what if you put like a special like glass or plexiglass or transparent aluminum, whatever, over the entire area, like maybe a foot or two off the ground. And then, of course, you'd have to have supports in the dug in, but you could, you know, you could put those supports in specific areas. That way you could actually walk over it and look down. Ah, there's the footprint. And nobody can mess with it because you're looking through like transparent aluminum and no one's going to get to it. I mean, how do you do that? Or do you take a big thing of glass, a covering, and you walk over there and you put it over just the footprint, and then everybody could walk over in their spacesuits and look at the footprint, and the footprint won't be molested. But
it's not just the footprint, Bob. The footprint
I know.
Literally right at the part of the lander that didn't go back up to rendezvous. You know, you'd want the whole landing site. But I love your idea of standing over the footprint and being able to see it. Maybe they'll make it so you could stand over the entire landing site, that site and all the other sites.
Right. Maybe you could put a dome over it and then build like a second floor, like 5 feet off of the ground with glass so that you could walk in this dome and you could look down and see where all the footsteps and you could see, you know, everything that was down there. Big, interesting project.
How many people are really going to go to the moon though?
Well, not Karen.
Wouldn't it be better to like archaeologically remove this and bring it back to Earth?
I don't think they could do it without destroying.
That would be challenging.
I mean, it would damage it, but the same way that you take footprints of animals as you would pour plaster in them.
Well, I think what they should do, instead of pouring plaster in them, and follow me on this, just take a highly detailed like laser scan.
3D rendering.
So,
that's better.
Yeah, you could do that easily.
Then we can recreate it.
LIDAR. You could do a LIDAR scan.
You know, God, I want to print it on a 3D printer I don't own yet, but one day I will.
We could do that now. We could actually do that in a very soon mission to the moon.
Yeah,
there's no reason
awesome.
Not to.
Maybe from orbit.
Yeah, you could LIDAR scan from far away. That would be pretty
cool.
What
kind of resolution could you get? Could you get like millimeter scale resolution?
I know that they can scan like whole 3D spaces and that you can even scan underground and stuff. So I'm assuming the resolution with LiDAR is pretty amazing. But I don't know how point to point it is.
Yeah. But I mean, even still, like think about, let's say that they talk about it and they're like, hey, we're sending people up there. We have a permanent base now. Hey, we're going to send this scanning equipment so they can, you know, just send a probe that's in orbit that'll scan the surface and take unbelievably detailed imagery of all those sites so we know exactly what's what and where.
I think that's a no-brainer.
Yeah,
that might also already kind of exist.
They could recreate that entire site in VR.
Oh, God.
Guys, that would be cool. We should probably look into how much of this they've already done.
Oh, they have. I was going to say, man, like you could walk around a VR space of the surface of Mars right now, you know, stitched together from all of the rover images.
We have every crater of the moon like beautifully mapped, I think. So I'm just wondering, you're right, Bob, like, do we have the footprints? Do we have it down to like millimeter resolution? I don't know. But I just think that taking that information and bringing it back home for posterity is going to reach more people than, you know, fantasizing about the handful of people that are ever going to actually spend time on the moon.
I agree with you, but still, you know, moving how would they do that?
Yeah, I agree, though. Preserving it is a good idea just for
scan it, recreate it.
In 200 years, there may be millions of people on the moon.
Yeah,
That's what we're talking about. That's why preservation is important.
Yeah, we're talking about 200 years from now.
Kara, what I'm hearing in the subtext that Kara's like, I'm not going to the moon. I'm not going to
be part of the subtext.
You won't catch me walking around.
Yeah, who would go to the moon? I'm not going to the moon.
Yeah, that sounds horrible.
Me too, Kara. Listen, I would love to have the nerve to go. I can't go.
There isn't enough Xanax
on the planet that would sustain me.
Jay, I'll stay home with you.
Yeah, we'll just like, Bob, send us the LiDAR, whatever you got.
We'll wave
goodbye to Bob LiDAR. And Steve and maybe Evan. What do you think, Evan?
Probably not.
Probably, yeah.
Probably
okay.
not.
The three of us will stay home.
I would go. Yeah, I would go. I'd probably die, but I'd go. All right.
Wait, I got one more thing that popped into my head. I may never think of this ever again. So, you know, in the movie Dune, when you might not know this, Kara, but they have this, the spice creatures that they bring in, and he's floating in like a tube of spice. I would have to float
in guild navigators.
I would have to be floating in like a test tube, human sized test tube of vaporized Xanax. Then I could go to the moon.
This is crazy.
All right.
Knock you out, wake you up.
Kara, so yes. We've gotten this question. I've personally gotten this question a lot. Once you're vaccinated, let's say you get your second dose and you're fully vaccinated, do you still need to wear a mask?
Yes, you do. And we'll talk about why. I think that this is an important topic because, more and more people are starting to grapple with what the world is going to look like post-vaccination. And we're all starting to see a light at the end of the tunnel. I also know that we've gotten direct emails from folks asking this very question. And also, I remember getting an email, and sorry to paraphrase because I didn't dig it up to whoever sent it, saying how, like, I should have been a little bit more careful during one of our discussions because I was talking about until we reach herd immunity, blah, blah, blah. Until we reach herd immunity, we can't even think about going back to normal. And so that's an important point that I want to make as we have this discussion is what exactly does life look like before and after, quote, herd immunity? And what do we really mean by that? So as far as masks are concerned, right, like Steve and I are, after our first doses, still waiting to get our second doses. If and when it's been, let's say, 10 to 14 days post second dose, the vaccine that we will have received will have it should work, right? It should do what it was designed to do. So then can we just rip off our masks and run freely through the forest? Well, I guess we could if we were in the forest all alone. But in the city, we need to really keep our masks on. And I'm going to talk about why that is the case. So first and foremost, when we talk about Pfizer and Moderna, which are the two that you hear us reference the most often here in the United States, because those are the two that we mostly have access to here in the United States, we know that the vaccines are about 95% effective if you get both doses and if you get those doses handled appropriately at the right time span, you know, you follow all the guidance to a T. Because in laboratory studies, what we're often looking at is efficacy. This is a specific but important distinction that I'm not sure we make a lot on the show, although I know it has come up, the difference between efficacy and effectiveness. Mm-hmm. An efficacy study is done under like pristine lab conditions. So it's saying if everything is done exactly correctly, this is the efficacy of this drug or of this vaccine. Effectiveness is really like the real world outcome, knowing that sometimes people come in late for their second dose, or maybe the vaccine was thawed a little bit prematurely, or, you know, there are all sorts of different things that in the real world might affect the effectiveness of a vaccine. So we know that these have a 95% efficacy. And even still, that means 1 in 20 people could get COVID even after vaccination. 1 in 20. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a risk. It's a real risk. No, I'm not saying it to scare you, because if all of us get vaccinated, then we are getting to herd immunity. And that 1 in 20 people being unprotected, the risk goes way down if literally everyone around you is protected.
Yeah, the point is that the virus can't spread.
Exactly, because there's no reservoir.
Doesn't have enough nodes of contact to continuously spread, so it gets shut down.
Exactly. Yeah. But here at the beginning, when you're only, let's say, in the first or second cohort of people getting vaccinated, the vast majority of people around you are still unprotected from an immune perspective. So even after you've been vaccinated, let's just say we're looking at this from a purely selfish perspective, there's still a chance you could catch COVID. Because you might be in that 5% group and the people around you are still unprotected. So keep that in mind. Now, moving on beyond kind of pure selfishness, we've got to remember that, well, I think I already kind of crossed this one off the list, but you're not going to be fully protected until something like 6 weeks after you get your first inoculation. And that's even if you follow the guidance perfectly. So I think Pfizer is a 3-week span between the two doses. Moderna is a 4-week span. And if you give yourself that 10 days to 2 weeks for full effectiveness after the final dose, we're talking about, you know, you get vaccinated the 1st of January, you're not going to be, you're not going to have full immunity. I say that, in the context of the full immunity that the vaccine will give you, until mid-February. So keep that in mind as well. But here's the real question that I think a lot of people are bringing up and reading about, and that's confusing a lot of people. And that's, if you're vaccinated, does it prevent you from spreading the virus? And the answer to that question right now is we still don't know. So when we look at the studies that were performed by these large pharmaceutical companies to determine whether or not we could safely put these vaccines out into the general public, they looked at two things. Does the vaccine work? And when we say, does the vaccine work, we're saying, does it keep people from getting sick with COVID? And two, is the vaccine safe? And once those two questions were answered to our satisfaction and to the satisfaction of the FDA or whatever your country's agency is that regulates these things, then, you know, many countries have their own version of this, but we had this emergency release. We had this vaccine that was made available to the public, knowing that it worked and that it was safe. What we didn't test at all was whether or not it actually prevents people from spreading the virus. So the question is, if you're not getting COVID, how could you spread a virus? Well, that's kind of complicated. So vaccines often provide two different levels of protection, and we can look at it in terms of different types of diseases. So the measles vaccine, part of the reason that it's so badass and why it's like amazing that people don't get it, is that it prevents you from ever even getting infected with the measles. So if you never get infected, you cannot carry the virus, you cannot spread it to other people. Whereas flu vaccines, and a lot of other, actually most other vaccines, they prevent you from having such a high viral load that you'll get sick. But many people still might have a low load of virus if they're exposed. And some of this has to do with how we take vaccines. Now, the Moderna and the Pfizer vaccines are injected vaccines. So there's like a systemic response. Some flu vaccines, and I think some polio vaccines, you can take through your nose. And when you take them through your nose or an oral way, they actually have an immediate response on the epithelium of your nose and mouth. Now, it seems to be the case that that is the kind of upper echelon, top tier way to take a vaccine for something that is airborne. That said, we're not there yet with the COVID vaccine. We have to take a shot. And so the question is, can we be populated with virus in our nose and mouth before it ever makes it through our body systemically and makes us sick enough that we start to show symptoms? Can we be populated and still spread it through a cough or a sneeze or through talking to other people? And we don't know. But there's a good chance that that might still be the case. So even if you yourself have a vaccine that prevents you from getting sick, it doesn't mean you might not still be able to collect and shed virus to other people. And that's something that we really have to keep in mind while the vast majority of the public is not yet vaccinated. The good news is we're studying it right now. There are some really interesting proposed trials. There's some retrospective trials, which don't really tell us a lot of information, but based on the people who already took the vaccine during the original trials, there might be some self-report information that we can gather. But then there's also some interesting trials that may take place on like college campuses where people are tested multiple times throughout the week for antibodies and for viral load within their nasal epithelium, and then they're able to do contact tracing, and that'll give us a much clearer picture of whether or not people who are vaccinated are still collecting low levels of virus in, or even high levels of virus that just never make it, that their immune system fights off really quickly in their nose or their mouth and then spreading it onto other people. So that's, you know, going to be a really interesting and important study. And then finally, we've got to remember that, well, actually a couple of things. We've got to remember that there are some people who will never be able to get the vaccine. And there are other people for whom if they get the vaccine, it doesn't seem to have the same effectiveness as young, healthy people. So people with cancer, for example, who have compromised immune systems, although the drug trials or the vaccine trials that were designed for Pfizer and Moderna did not allow these individuals in the study. After the fact, they realized that some people developed cancer or were diagnosed with cancer during the study. And so they're able to kind of look at this very tiny cohort. And although this is not, you know, robust data, say, interestingly, their protection was only about 76%. And that's compared to the 95% in the general population who took the vaccine. And so with further analysis, we may realize that people with compromised immune systems, although the vaccine may be, you know, highly recommended for them, which we don't know yet, their protection might not be as high. And of course, there are some people who can't take the vaccine. People who have blood clotting disorders, for example, or who are taking Coumadin or warfarin right now aren't supposed to take the vaccine. And a lot of cancer patients, for example, are in that vulnerable group. So again, we have to protect them by wearing our mask. And then finally, as of right now, it looks like all the new variants of the coronavirus are potentially going to be targeted by this vaccine. But we don't know if that's going to continue to be the case. And we don't know if the COVID vaccine is going to be much more like the flu vaccine in the sense that we're going to be chasing new mutations all the time, new genetic variants. We do know that these new genetic variants do seem to be significantly more contagious, which could just mean a higher number of caseload, like a higher case count, which ultimately affects the calculus for vaccination. So the truth of the matter is, until we get to a place where herd immunity is significant, where the vast majority of the population is vaccinated, and where we have a little bit more information, scientific information, about what vaccination really does offer in terms of the spread of the virus, it's imperative that we continue with all of the same CDC guidance that has been made to this point. Wear a mask over both your nose and your mouth. That's the most important part. Stay at least 6 feet away from others. Avoid crowds. Avoid poorly ventilated spaces. And wash your hands often. Even if you're vaccinated, it's imperative that you continue to follow this guidance, both to keep yourself safe and even more importantly, probably to keep others around you safe.
Yeah. So to put this into context, like when we get towards the end of an epidemic, a pandemic, or whatever, the risk to the individual is going down, right? Because we're shutting down the pandemic. But that's right. When we have to keep our foot on the gas, right? That's when we absolutely have to keep going.
When psychologically, we often will do the opposite, yeah. Which is
so it's like we're so close to eradicating polio. Now's not the time to stop taking polio vaccines,
right.
Even though your risk may be super low. we have to make sure that the world is vaccinated until it's eradicated. So until we get to herd immunity and we really shut down the pandemic, we have to just keep pushing. We're almost there. Don't give up yet.
Yeah.
But yeah, don't ease up. Just because you got
yeah, just because you're vaccinated, that is not. And I think take a note from the healthcare workers who have many of whom have studied this in detail, many of whom are living this every single day. If you speak to healthcare workers on the front lines, a lot of them are saying a new normal for me is that I will always be masked at work.
Mm-hmm. All right, Evan, I hear the CIA just declassified a whole crop of new UFO documents.
Oh, yes, they did. More than 3 decades worth of records. They are now available to the public. The United States Central Intelligence Agency has released what they claim to be all of their intelligence on unidentified flying objects, UFOs, but we now more commonly refer to them as unexplained aerial phenomenon. Or
Evan, all their declassified documents.
What did I say?
You said just all their documents.
You said all their documents.
It's just all their declassified documents.
All their declassified documents. Yes, thank you. Right. They didn't they didn't just open up their door and say, come on in and have anything you want.
Which of course means that the UFO enthusiasts will never be satisfied.
Of course not. Please, that's not what this is about. Satisfying them? Well, this was quite a work in progress to get to this point, though. It took, the better part of 3 decades. They've been working on this since the 1990s. One group in particular called the Black Vault. They've been filing what are called Freedom of Information Act requests, FOIA requests.
FOIA.
Yep. And just last year, they're saying mid last year, the CIA finally came up with a trove of documents that they handed over because of all those requests to the Black Vault. And the Black Vault just got done apparently going through them all, and they made them available up on their website. You can go and see them all if you would like. The requests piled up so much over time that it became known as the UFO Collection, and they actually put this thing on a CD-ROM. So that tells you about kind of how long ago they were compiling this stuff and actually getting it ready as part of these requests. And again, this dates back to the 1990s, these FOIA requests. So it's kind of been a long time coming. And no doubt traffic to the website has increased massively, maybe over the last few days since this was announced. And it arrives before officials from the U.S. Department of Defense and intelligence agencies. They're supposed to go before Congress and explain to Congress everything that they know about UFOs and UAPs. So that is also coming up later in this year. It came through as part of the latest COVID-19 relief package that came through at the end of the year. Was this component to it? You know, it didn't get much press at the time because COVID's the most important part of this. But this directive saying that they have to submit a report within 180 days to satisfy this particular act that went into effect. So they're going to be explaining to Congress what's going on. And Steve, as you alluded to, what this does is it will, yes, all these documents and information is out there, but what are people really going to learn from it? It sounds like just it's going to be a series of anecdotes and stories and people's opinions on a lot of different things. It's not as if these reports are going to say, we have this piece of material. We have absolutely no idea how to analyze it for its components or know what it's made of. And, you know, here it is and here's how you can get it. And there's not going to be an alien autopsy video or something equivalent that's going to be revealed. And even if it was, you'd have to be skeptical of it. So how much further really does this satisfy the people who believe that we are being visited by aliens, by extraterrestrials?
Zero.
Not at all. Plus, on top of that, with it being the CIA, and this is what the CIA is claiming, that they've handed everything over. You know, they're inherently skeptical of the CIA to begin with, and they're going to be like, well, of course they're not going to hand everything over to us. They're going to keep all the pieces that would show the direct evidence of alien visitations and all those things, based on whatever subcode or subsection or presidential order from 1973 or what have you. They'll come up with all sorts of excuses. So while it makes for interesting headlines, and yes, it does comply with the laws we have in this country about FOIA, which are very important because, you know, we do have a right to know about a lot of different things that's going on with our government. As far as the overall UFO conspiracies, I don't think this moves the ball at all as far as they're concerned, and certainly they will never be satisfied.
Yeah, so as you said, there's no smoking gun. And this dark black vault, whatever it is, the black vault, they have like millions of documents. There's no smoking gun in the documents that they have. Yeah. And so, you know, skeptics will say, well, there's no smoking gun, right? That's because there's no UFOs. And then the true believers will say, well, they're not releasing the smoking gun because they're the government and they're going to keep them classified. Yeah. So what effect does this have? None. None at all.
Zero.
All right. Thanks, Evan. Yep. Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
All right, guys. Last week I played this noisy. That's it. So just a quick disclaimer. We're recording the show on Sunday, which means I did not get that many submissions, but I did get a good enough, it's quote unquote good enough. So Michael Blaney wrote in and said, "Hey Jay, you are a tricky bastard. This one is wild." My guess for this noisy is pink noise. It's similar to white noise. Real white noise, not birds chirping or a waterfall or something like that, but the energy of each frequency drops as it increases, meaning that every octave has equal power, making a more balanced sound than white noise. That is not correct, although, of course, this sound has a very much a white noise sound to it, without a doubt. But that was not correct. Stuart Harrington wrote in, said, "It's a bee ball. You wanted specific, so it, of course, has to be Asian honeybees assassinating a murder hornet. And it's my favorite. It's my birthday week, so you have to give it to me, even if I'm wrong."
Mm-hmm.
Stuart, since it's your birthday, I'll give you nothing. You were wrong on your birthday. Wow.
Deal with it.
Wow, man. Deal with it. Happy birthday. Oliver Bayer wrote in, "Hey, Jay, I knew immediately who last week's noisy was." Sure you did. you could say that afterwards. He said, but didn't mail you since I thought that many people would know. Never say that to yourself. Always email me. So he says, "Therefore, I will now always write to you if I have the slightest idea. No idea about this week, though, but I'm going to say it's a huge swarm of insects like locusts flying and buzzing." Again, insects, absolutely. There's insect noises that sound like this. This, however, is not the answer. I have one more guess here. This was from Kyle Pizzola, and he says, "Hello, this sounds like the postal workers ziplining over Steve's house delivering packages to avoid the dogs."
2 points for being clever.
He said, "It does sound like a zip line, though." And I agree. I've been on zip lines, and they do have that kind of sound, that zippy sound to it. Lots of things sound like lots of things. We have a partial winner this week, because I did want specifics. John Blair wrote in and said, "Hi, Jay, Evan, whatever. I think this week's noisy is an indoor FPV drone race." Okay.
Ooh, those are fun.
Oh, totally. The first person point of view, the drone race. Oh my God, they're
so cool.
The pilots are amazing.
They go so fast.
Yeah, they're so skilled. I mean, those pilots like have it down. They don't even have to think about it. They're just flying as if it's their own body, you know. But okay, so let me tell you what this actually is. Yes, this does have something to do with drones, but this one in particular is very specific. So the guy that sent this in, his name was John, and he says, "I race drones, I teach drones, and I am part of a drone research program at a local university. When most people hear the word drone, they think of quadcopters, right?" So that would be, and this is me talking, that's basically the thing that's flying has four propeller blades on it. That are like the four corners of it, or they could be in a rectangular formation. And that's why they say quad, because there's four of the blades. "Like most aerial photography and racing drones, or they think some sort of unmanned military aircraft, but in fact, there are thousands of variations of drones. I recently came across this video of an omnicopter, which I happen to think is the most interesting variation I've seen." So let me tell you what this is. So the omnicopter, and this is still from his email, but he quoted it, so it must be from the website. "The omnicopter is an omnidirectional aircraft that can generate force and torques in any direction, allowing it to fly at arbitrary attitudes." Okay, so what does that mean? If you saw the omnicopter that we're talking about, it is actually in the shape of a cube. And there are blades pointing in every direction. Like, so you would think left, right, up and, you know, left, right, north, south, east, and west, and then on every angle. So I believe in total it has eight blades, or eight sets of propellers. That means that this thing could, of course, hover, but it can go in any direction, up, sideways, on a complete diagonal. And it's weird. When you see the thing fly, it looks as if, you know, like it's moving on a track almost, right? Because it can go in any direction. So they had three of them that were following the same exact path in space, and one was following the other, then the other one was following the other. So there's three of them, and they were going on like it looked like a 3D racetrack. And it was amazing because the accuracy of these things were so precise that it really did look like they had, you know, you would think your brain's telling you they must be on a track to be that accurate, you know? This week's Noisy was sent in by a listener named Miklos Bolza, and check it out. That's all I'm giving you. All right, so if you think you know what that Noisy is, or if you heard something cool this week, email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
Thank you, brother. A couple of quick emails. First, a correction from last week. We were talking about supercapacitors and the fact that they could charge and discharge very quickly. So I brought up the idea that, yes, if you had a supercapacitor in your car, you could charge it very quickly in emergencies because they could take the charge so quickly. And a lot of people pointed out that even if the supercapacitor could take a charge very quickly, you still have to give up a charge very quickly. So if you plug it into your outlet in your house, it's still going to take about a mile a minute to charge it up, right? It's going to take a half an hour to get that 30 miles on there. That's correct. So then you would need some kind of fast charger, which might double it, but it's still going to be 15 minutes. Although one email said you could have a capacitor in your house, which you keep charged. That could be just slow charging in the background. And then when you need to fast charge your car, you could fast charge it from that. That's a great idea. You could do
like
that.
Like that could come from your solar panels or something.
Yeah, or whatever. You just keep it. Just cool. You have a, yeah, that's so your fast charger itself is a supercapacitor that could dump the charge very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Also on the road, like recharging stations could be industrial level rechargers, you know, so they're still, it still may be limited by how robust they can be, but it could be fairly fast, much faster than your home would be. So thanks for everyone who pointed that out. Also, very quickly, I don't want to really do a deep dive on this, but we did get a number of people email us this. There's a viral video going around of a woman who claims that she is having a significant neurological side effect from the Moderna vaccine. You guys seen this?
Mm-hmm. No.
So, you know, I don't like commenting on people's medical neurological conditions in public, whether they're my patient or not. It's bad either way, you know. I've never examined this person. I have no idea what they have. But here's the thing. If you're putting it in the public domain and saying this is a risk of the Moderna vaccine and we're in the middle of a pandemic, you kind of forfeited your right to privacy when you did that.
Right.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
And now you're kind of, you know, entering the public discourse, making yourself evidence. And so, you know, we kind of have no choice but to comment on at least the evidence you presented. So let me just say a couple of things. First of all, if I looked at this video of her shaking without any context, what it looks like to me as a neurologist is what we call a conversion disorder, which basically means that it's more psychological than neurological. It doesn't mean she's faking. I hate the fact, that's the other thing, you put these things online, all the comments are shite. Like every comment is either, my hopes and prayers are with you, which is fine, or... you know, that, oh yeah, these vaccines are a scam and blah, 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 or try this detox, you know, all this crap, or it's she's faking. No, neither of these things are true. This is a medical condition. It's just not a neurological condition, and it's not a physiological side effect to the vaccine. Some people respond to stress this way. That's just the way, the way their mind works. It's okay. You shouldn't stigmatize it and or blame her or think that she's faking or anything like that. But this probably wasn't a biological response to the vaccine. Now, if multiple people start reporting the same thing, we have to investigate it. If you recall, in Denmark, there was in Finland, that area, there was a a number of people who came down with narcolepsy after a specific brand of the flu vaccine.
Interesting.
Remember that?
I don't. And that's fascinating.
At first, I was like, yeah, it's one or two isolated cases. We've got to keep an eye on this. But in retrospect, after you look at all the data, it almost certainly was a side effect of the vaccine.
Wow.
But it was like, it was one particular brand, and it's no longer out there, so don't worry about that. But they kind of backtracked what was happening and showed that, yeah, that was a vaccine side effect.
Thus far with COVID, it's literally just local reactions.
Local pain and maybe a little bit of a fever, you know.
And even the, like joint pain, fever, that seems to be with the second vaccine. Yeah.
Yeah.
When you've got more immunity. And actually, from what I've been reading, the allergic response is actually pretty low with this vaccine. Like even compared to some other vaccines, it's a pretty low risk of having an allergic response.
Yeah. But unfortunately, this person's like, don't get the vaccine. Look what happened to me. It's like, sorry, you can't say that. You can't. Right. This is, again, the lottery. This is like, it's funny because it's the lottery fallacy and the gambler's fallacy kind of thing. It's like, but it happened right after the vaccine. Yes, you give millions of people the vaccine. Some people are going to have stuff happen to them right afterwards by chance alone. Obviously, if it were one person got the vaccine and something bad happened, you would be more concerned than if 10 million people get the vaccine and one of them has something happen. Then the probability that that was a chance reaction is much greater, right? So it's a strangely similar kind of logic at play here.
I'm also fascinated, Steve, by the psychological component of vaccine reaction. Mm-hmm. Like how often, because I see this even in my own family, where people seem to have a narrative that like every time I get vaccinated, X happens. I know this about my body. And it's like, well, don't you think that if you go into it having that intense expectation that you're going to find evidence to support it?
What we call the nocebo effect, where you have a psychological negative reaction partly because you're expecting to.
Because you're expecting it. Yeah. And it's such a difficult thing to break out of because it's almost like a negative feedback loop because, of course, just even throughout the day, you might have little – like after I got my first vaccine, they have you sit for 15 minutes at my hospital and just wait. And they come up to you after you've set your timer and they say, do you have any symptoms? And I remember being like, well, my palms are a little sweaty, but I think it's just hot in here. And they were like, it's not hot in here. Maybe you should sit for another 5 minutes. And after 5 minutes, I was like, I'm fine. And they were like, are you sure? And I was like, yeah, I'm pretty sure it's because I drank an entire coffee before I sat down to get vaccinated and haven't eaten anything yet today.
See, for me, Karen, they just asked me, are you going to be around other people for the next 10, 15 minutes? I'm like, yeah, yeah.
Oh, really?
They didn't want you to be alone. So if you had an anaphylactic reaction, nobody would be able to see it.
For us, they had a blood pressure monitor and they had a nursing station ready to go. And then they give you a hotline just in case anything comes up. You know, they were like trying to be extra careful, which I get. I mean, it's fair. Yeah. But it they all knew it was being extra careful. But, you know, my experience had nothing to do with the vaccine. But of course, I could have very easily said, anytime I get vaccinated, I have, you know, increased heart rate and my palms get really sweaty. Well, yeah, but that could be nerves. That could be expectation. And so it's a really complicated phenomenon. How much of this is psychological?
Totally. So, and just the final word here. So, you know, other neurologists have commented publicly about this, again, being circumspect like I am, but saying, yeah, this doesn't correspond with any like movement disorder or anything. It's certainly not seizures. It doesn't really correspond with anything else. So we tend to categorize those as a conversion reaction. But even if this were an actual legit reaction to the vaccine, it's still a million to one. Millions of people have gotten this vaccine. And this is like the only one with this kind of reaction. So it's still statistically massively in your benefit to get the vaccine. And this is almost certainly not a vaccine reaction. Okay, one full email. This is a really interesting thing I want to talk about. This comes from Brody from Australia, and he writes, "Hi all, especially Kara, with regards to this question. Reading the a game designer's analysis of QAnon, I realized that the concept of guided apophenia is the evil counter to the skeptic's approach of helping people to realize their failures of critical thinking through gently guiding them with rational questions. I'm interested to get your thoughts on what the counter to this approach could be. Is it through education about pareidolia and apophenia? Regardless, perhaps apophenia is a good candidate for what's the word. I think we've talked about it before. But apophenia, mm-hmm. very quickly. Yeah, it's the more general idea of seeing connections among things when there isn't one. It's an illusory connection.
Mm-hmm. Right, like pareidolia is a type of apophenia.
Yeah, exactly. It's a visual apophenia. And he links to an article, which we'll link to in the show notes, about a game designer noting that how often they accidentally create clues that they didn't intend to create. At least for me, I've both been played a lot of games and I've written games for other people to play. So I've been on both sides of this phenomenon that the random details of the game begin to look like clues or that they're right. deliberate. And so here's the thing. When you're playing a game, let's say you're doing a, you know, whatever, breakout room or a role-playing game or whatever, or even a video game, and the game designer says, like, in the game that they made, a video game, there was wood chips on the floor, and the wood chips accidentally fell into the pattern of an arrow pointing at a blank wall, and that a lot of players would get stuck trying to figure out like what was going on with this blank wall. Mm-hmm. And of course, there were also tools in the room. So they said, well, that's not a coincidence. I must be meant to use these tools to get into that wall somehow. And this was totally not the case. It was completely at random. But they were certain that that was how they needed to get through the next challenge of the game. But it was completely accidental. And I've been there too, where like the thing is, you know, the game was designed by a person. And when you play games, like right now, I'm playing my way through Half-Life Alyx. And it's absolutely part of your thinking in terms of solving puzzles. This thing is here. It may be here for me to use to solve the next challenge that I have.
Maybe
like
not.
That's a clue in and of itself. The fact that it exists is
right,
a clue.
Right, because the game was designed.
Right.
Yeah.
But what's fascinating is that some people react to the real world as if it were designed.
People believe the real world was designed.
That's the point. Then it's the illusion of a designer, right? The invisible hand behind, you know, what's happening. Hyperactive agency detection. So the video game is like a little microcosm of hyperactive agency detection where you think that everything is deliberate. And it's actually reasonable in a game because a lot of things are deliberate, but it shows you even there, people will still find stuff, false patterns. They'll still engage in apophenia. And I've done that too. Like I've been the person writing the game, you know, for tabletop role-playing games, things like that, where people key into something that I didn't intend for them to key into, and it takes them off on a tangent that is a complete red herring. And it's just because if you have enough detail in your world, all that noise, but it's amazing how confident people get about these fake patterns that they see.
And then some designers utilize that intentionally, right? Like if you're thinking about a murder mystery, the whole point is to make people go off and think that other people were responsible or think that, you know, all these different tangents are the actual path. You want to throw them off the trail.
The red herring. Yeah, I do that. Yeah. I do that as a game designer too. I throw in tons of red herrings just so that they can't know something's important simply because it's there.
Right, but there has to be a resolution to it. So if they go to investigate it, they have to be able to realize, okay, at some point I got a new piece of information. This was not right. I have to go back.
So does guided apophenia specifically refer to intending apophenia, like forcing apophenia upon the game players?
Well, it can, yeah, but it could also be inadvertent guided apophenia.
Right, right.
But they're saying like QAnon is doing it deliberately. Like it's a conspiracy theory.
Yeah.
They're picking up the threads of reality and weaving them together into a pattern that's not real.
With all these random breadcrumbs that are completely arbitrary, but of course you can always find patternicity, especially as we know if other group members reinforce it to you.
Exactly.
Oh yeah.
You know, you've done this, like you're looking at animals and clouds, and you might be looking in the general direction of a random cloud that doesn't look like anything. And then someone says, ooh, do you see the dragon? Look, there's its head and there's its tail. And then you see it, because then your brain fills in the pattern that's being suggested to you.
Yeah,
or if you're with audio pareidolia, it's very powerful. If somebody says, do you hear them saying, because I live with Satan or something? Then you, then you start to hear it, and you can't not hear it after.
Why is it always about Satan?
Well, it's all these ghost shows when they hear all this noise in the recording. That's exactly what that is.
Right. Yeah. All audio pareidolia. But it's interesting, the idea that people are doing it deliberately to foment a conspiracy theory, and that they're basically doing what game designers do, is a very interesting one.
Yeah.
Because I do think that's, they're onto something there. All right, let's move on with science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine, one fictitious. And I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. It's only been a couple of days since the last episode. Weekends are very, very slow news days. So, of course, there's a theme for this one. And the theme is, this is for you, Kara. You ready?
No.
Material science.
Yes! I want to go last.
No, your favorite.
I went first last week.
Here we go. Item number one. Tantalum is a silvery metal, highly corrosion resistant, that is used in some electronics and as medical implants. Item number two, the oldest evidence of forging iron predates the Iron Age by 2,000 years and used meteoric iron as the source. And item number three, radium, the element most responsible for the death of Marie Curie, is also the most radioactive substance known. Bob, go first.
All right, tantalum. Oh my God, that name just leaps out at me. I know it. Am I remembering a Star Trek episode? Or crap. Damn you, science fiction.
Gold pressed tantalum.
Silvery metal.
Right, gold pressed tantalum.
Medical implants. Yeah, I mean, God. I don't know. It does ring a bell, though. Let's go to the second one here. Forging iron. 2,000 years. That's huge. I could see, some evidence of forging going on using meteoric iron, very rarely happening. I could see them finding evidence of that, but it never took off. So it didn't become the Iron Age, because I could see that happening. It doesn't seem unreasonable to me. So let's go to radium. All right, so is radium the most radioactive substance known?
Since you're going first, I'll clarify what most radioactive means. So it's not the shortest half-life. Not the most unstable. It's the one that gives off the most particles per weight.
Yeah, that's what I would assume. Yeah, I'll say radium
is a fiction.
The not true one. Yeah.
Okay, Jay.
Yeah, fiction. That's what it's called.
God, I mean, I am a fan of metals. I know that sounds weird, but I do read about metals from time to time. I do recognize the word, but I don't know if Steve's just picking some random element or whatever. But I don't see any reason to not believe it, because if it was corrosion resistant, it would, I could see it being used for those two things. The second one here about forging iron, the oldest evidence of forging iron actually predates the Iron Age by 2,000 years. I know that there is meteoric iron. So, this is definitely plausible. It's the forging of it. And then the last one, radium, the element most responsible for the death of Marie Curie, is also the most radioactive substance known. All right, so my only thing about radium here is, is it the most radioactive substance known? All right, I'm going to GWB. I'll say that it's the radium one is the fake.
Okay, Kara.
One thing I will let you guys know is that I was lucky this week to watch the new movie Radioactive, which is about Marie Curie's life.
What?
And starring Rosamund Pike and directed by Marjan Satrapi. I actually got to interview the two of them for a panel by American Cinematheque. So I happened to watch a movie about radium this week. That said, I will also tell you the answer to that question was not in the movie.
No spoilers.
Oh my God. All right. I was wondering where you're going with that.
Although you guys should check out this interview once it becomes available, because a great movie.
Yeah, absolutely.
Really cool people. Yeah. So I'm going to go back to the beginning. Tantalum sounds like you made it up, but also so many fun things in science do sound like they're made up by creative people, so I wouldn't put it past somebody to name a metal tantalum. And then forging iron, if forging does necessitate both heat and pounding, I still don't, this doesn't seem that implausible. I mean, it's amazing, and it has us recalibrate a lot of things. But that said, meteoric iron, as we know, does exist, and fire was harnessed millions of years ago. So I don't see why early humans couldn't have attempted to forge iron if they found this cool metallic substance that was like heavy and strong, that they wouldn't say, ooh, this seems better than stone for a thing. Maybe I can try and melt it down. I don't know. It seems possible. Maybe not plausible, but possible. But radium is a naturally occurring substance. I do know that they collected it from this ore. It took tons and tons and tons of this ore that they collected from a mine in order to purify until they had a tiny amount of radium. And that was basically their life's work to get the Nobels. Marie actually ended up with two Nobels. I don't know if you guys know that.
Mm-hmm.
I know that this is a naturally occurring element, although in very small quantities. And my assumption is that there are elements that have been created, produced, discovered for that reason that are probably more radioactive. So I think I'm going to go with the guys and say that's the fiction.
Okay. And Evan?
Well, I'm not going alone this week. I'll be with everyone else. I remember Carl Sagan talking about plutonium in the original Cosmos, and he brought that up as an example of radioactive substances. And, you know, I'll just go with that because I think he would have used radium as his example, if not plutonium. I don't know if it's plutonium, maybe not anymore, but therefore, I'm with everyone else. Radium's fiction.
Although I will ask Steve before you continue, mm-hmm. does plutonium glow? Because radium legit glows.
Yeah, radium
green,
glows. Radium glows
which
blue.
You can see it. No, I think it's green.
No, it's blue.
Are you sure?
Yep, positive.
Radium?
Blue. I mean, I just looked at it. Obviously, I read it for this item.
But radium dials are green. Like, it's always portrayed as being green.
It by itself, if you're just looking at the radium, it glows a little bit blue.
Oh, look at this. Even without the phosphor, pure radium emits enough to excite, causing it to glow. The color isn't green, though, but a pale blue. Why does everybody portray it as green?
Hollywood got
the Simpsons.
Yeah, exactly.
And because of...
All right, let's take these in order. Item number one, tantalum is a silvery metal, highly corrosion resistant, that is used in some electronics and as medical implants. You guys all think that tantalum actually exists. And this
yeah,
one
right. Oh, that's the...
is science. This is science.
Tantalum. I know. I almost went that way. Almost.
I mean, I included it because I just can't remember ever hearing of it before. I know at some point I've read every element, but it just didn't stick with me. You don't hear about it in everyday life, you know.
And it sounds made up, but then again, it is made up.
Because, well, it's based on, everything's made up, right? It's based on tantalus. I mean, that's who it was named after. It's a metal. You know, there's 38, I think, different transition metals. They all have the same, they all have metal, you know, characteristics that are, they're ductile and whatever. So yeah, this is a metal, just like many other metals. And it's, it's most impressive feature is that it's very corrosion resistant. So, I mean, like, even you could use it to contain things like acids that would eat away other things. And it also has electronic properties that can use it in electronics, and it doesn't react with anything. So it's great for medical implants. And it doesn't react, but there's no biological reactivity to the tantalum.
Oh, that's nice.
All right, let's go to number three, radium, the element most responsible for the death of Marie Curie, is also the most radioactive substance known. You guys all think this is the fiction. Let me give you a little bit more background. So, Kara, you're correct. Curie worked mainly with uranium, but in uranium, there are tiny amounts of other radioactive components. And it was actually those tiny amounts of stuff like radium that is what killed her, because it's much more like thousands of times more radioactive than uranium itself.
Mm-hmm.
But there's something that's even much more radioactive than radium.
Tantalum? That,
nope.
Plutonium?
Plutonium?
Nope.
Oh.
Uranium-234?
Nope. It's not any isotope of uranium. It's not any isotope of plutonium. It's polonium.
Polonium.
Ooh, that. Oh, shit. I should have thought of polonium. That's what
polonium, which was also
used to kill everyone with.
That's the other element that was mixed in with the uranium, although much less of it. And it's many times more radioactive than even radium. So that was also contributing to it. It was named after Poland. So she was credited with discovering polonium, and she named it after
who? Curie?
Yeah, Curie.
Oh, cool. Yeah, they were just, I was remembering what it's called. It was pitch blend. Pitch blend is what they used in order to purify and yeah, that's a uraninite mineral that occurs in these big masses that they pulled out of, that they had shipped to them, like tons and tons of pitch blend from a mine.
Yes, exactly.
A mine.
Yeah. That's and it's right. Uranium, you're right. It's uranium rich. But uranium had already been discovered at that point. And they were like, there's something in there that's not accounted for. And
there was more radioactivity than could be accounted for by the uranium. That's that was the radium and the polonium.
And they were like, we think we might have discovered a new element. And it turns out they actually discovered two.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, wow. Which is pretty cool.
It's amazing. Oh, yeah, you got this metal, this material or whatever. And just by being near it, it slowly kills you. Just by being close. Yeah.
Right, but
it's
they didn't know.
Yeah.
And at the time, people thought it was a treatment.
Oh, yeah. It's just amazing to think when you have no knowledge of, you know, of otherwise, you know, well over 100, 200 years ago, to think that a substance near you could kill you like that. That wasn't like, obviously, like a gas that, you know, you were breathing in. Just the, you know, these radioactive particles that you had no conception of at all.
Yeah. But they did have a concept. Like Marie Curie had a conception of what radioactivity was. I mean, she named radioactivity. She really understood what
was
going on in the
cell. She just didn't realize how biologically harmful it was.
Exactly. But they were starting to see, obviously, that how X-rays worked based on that. It was at
the
same time period
that was realized. The beginnings of understanding it.
All right, let's go back to number two. The oldest evidence of forging iron predates the Iron Age by 2,000 years and used meteoric iron as the source. That is science.
Cool.
Cool.
So,
what did they make?
So the Iron Age was when they were smelting and forging iron and using it extensively. So, you know, the use of iron from meteorites, in retrospect, they're not counting that as part of the official Iron Age.
So what was the source of iron, Steve, during the Iron Age? Was it like mined?
Iron ore, yeah. It was iron ore.
Okay. So they found sources and then they intentionally mined them out of those.
Yeah, so iron rock actually is exposed to the surface, too. Like the first parts of it they found in probably riverbeds.
But I'm assuming that there was a concerted effort to identify and then to mine this iron during the Iron Age.
Eventually, I'll get to that in a second. But iron in a meteorite exists already in a purified form and already alloyed with nickel. It's like, which is a really good, like iron nickel alloys are good, you know.
Yeah, it's all the homework's done for you.
It's heavy and it's shiny and it's like obvious.
The universe
you are lucky enough to find it.
The first evidence of using meteorite iron was in Egypt 5,000 years ago. So 3,000, you know, the Iron Age started around 3,000 years ago, like 1200 BCE. So that's like whatever, 3,200 years ago. But 2,000 years prior to that, they were using heat to forge the bits of the meteorite into little beads. That's it. They weren't making stuff out, weapons or tools out of it. They
just
were making
like to play with it.
Decorative beads out of it. It was just a status symbol because it was a rare thing.
Rare. Yeah.
That so groks with when I did that meteorite piece for Nat Geo and I was in Morocco in the Saharan desert out with a Sahuari guide. And I remember he said this one phrase and everybody started laughing during the interview. He said, when you are out on camel, you see only three things that are black against the sand. You see old tires, camel shit, and meteorite. And like, it just stands out so broadly against the sand.
Like the that Arctic leads too. To the next thing I was going to talk about. Here was that in the Arctic, the Inuit also found and used meteoric iron, but they used them for their weapons. And
there was no tires and camel shit up there.
That's right.
Yeah,
this was maybe 1,200 years ago. So this was after the Iron Age. So this was the oldest. But they were, and in fact, there was one big meteor that landed in Greenland. That got traded all over the Northeast, you know, there. because they could trace it back. What they were doing was cladding like their spear tips in iron from this meteor.
Oh my god! Example.
Oh, smart! Powerful. Like yeah. reinforcing it.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Material science from nice. The heavens.
Yeah,
I love this. Right. That's cool.
But just very, very quickly. So you know, the bronze is actually a really good metal. You know, and it's very much easier to make. You could melt the copper and the tin in pots. You know, and. And you could just cast with it, right? Although it's, you know, it's not nearly as strong as iron. It's like if you make a sword out of bronze, the risk of it breaking is pretty good. Mm. But at the time, iron, they didn't have the technology to really, it was very difficult to smelt iron, right? You couldn't.
Oh, because it requires higher heat.
Higher heat, need a brick oven, you know, and also like raw pig iron, like raw iron, it has a lot of impurities in it, which makes it crap. So actually, the low-tech iron was worse than bronze.
Makes sense.
And in fact, the switch from bronze to iron happened when these ancient civilizations were collapsing, like Greece, because they lost their infrastructure where they were sourcing their copper and tin. So they couldn't make their bronze anymore, so they had to use the shitty iron. But of course, then they figured out how to make it into steel, and then boom, they were off to the races.
That's it.
Once they figured out how to,
even then, I wonder if meteorites were like just this prized source.
Yeah, sure. It's a great source. Iron. It's a great source of iron. But so it was partly just, you know, being able to, there was just the metallurgy of working with iron, getting rid of the impurities, but also regulating how much carbon is in there, whether you are burning it off or adding carbon. Once you can figure that out to make like hardenable steel, then that's when like the real Iron Age begins. But it's interesting to think that for a time, just given the technology, bronze was actually a superior metal than the crappy iron until you learn how to make it into higher quality. Okay, so you guys swept me again, man. Clearly, I got to make these things harder.
No, they're hard. They're hard.
They were hard. Yeah,
we're just you know smart.
All right, Evan, give us a quote.
And I went first.
This week's quote was suggested by listener Brian Hart, whom we met many, many, many years ago at various TAMs and became a friend of the SGU. Thank you, Brian. We are all capable of believing things which we know to be untrue, and then, when we are finally proved wrong, impudently twisting the facts so as to show that we were right. George Orwell wrote that.
Very 1984.
Yeah.
Kind of fits with George Orwell.
Absolutely. Yep.
All right, guys. So in podcasting time frame, we're doing our 12-hour show right now, so I hope it's going well.
Flawless.
I'm looking forward to it. I think it's going to be great. The content's good. So
it'll be a lot of fun.
Yeah, it'll be a lot of fun. And probably next week's podcast will be a piece of the 12-hour show. We'll, you know, I'll edit together some of the best bits into a podcast. That'll be next week's show. And then we'll return to record a regular show in 2 weeks. So thank you all for joining me this week.
Thank you.
You got it, brother.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.